13 chapters to cover, something like that. So we're going to move fairly rapidly, although, my goodness, some of these chapters immediately before us have a lot of miscellaneous short things that always tends to bog us down because I have something to say about each thing. It's much nicer when a whole chapter talks about one issue and I can just read the chapter and make a few comments on that issue. But whenever a chapter has 6 or 7 or 8 different issues in it, the temptation is to give a complete, you know, exposition on each subject, and that always ends up being too time-consuming. So I'll try to move quickly, but not omit important comments. And we're in chapter 22. And it begins, "You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and hide yourself from them. You shall certainly bring them back to your brother. And if your brother is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it to your own house, and it shall remain with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. You shall do the same with his donkey, and so shall you do with his garment. With any lost thing of your brother's, which he has lost and you have found, you shall do likewise. You must not hide yourself, that is, you shouldn't seek to keep it." Now, there is one exception to this rule, and that is a runaway slave. According to chapter 23, verses 15 and 16, if a slave runs away from his master and comes to you, you shall not turn him back over to his master. So a slave was of a different category than other property under the law. He was a human being, and therefore was not to be regarded simply as a piece of property. Although, of course, the institution of slavery does presuppose that, to a certain extent, the person is property of his master, yet obviously of a different sort than an ox or an ass or something else that may wander off. In such a case, with anything except a runaway slave, if you find something that belongs to your master, you're supposed to give it back to him. If you don't know who he is, you just hang on to it until someone comes looking for it. And verse 4 says, "You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fall down along the road and hide yourself from them. You shall surely help him lift them up again." Now, between verse 1 and verse 4, we have two kinds of instruction. One is, if your neighbor's animal runs away, you should bring it back to him. And secondly, if you see your neighbor's animal struggle under its load, you shall help it back up. Both of these things were also said, of course, you might recall, back in Exodus chapter 23, verses 4 and 5. Only they were said about your enemy. There. Here it is simply your neighbor. It was actually stated that even if this neighbor is an enemy of yours, in Exodus 23, verses 4 and 5, if you see the ox or the ass of your enemy, of him that hates you, wandering off, you have to take it back to him. If you see the ass of him that hates you fall under its load, and you would rather not help it, you must anyway. So here it is more general. Your neighbor. Your neighbor might be friendly or not towards you. Your neighbor might be an enemy or a friend. But regardless, as you add the information from Exodus to this, you see that this is true even if you are not on good terms with your neighbor. You still have to regard its property rights and show compassion toward him. In verse 5 here, "A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are an abomination to the Lord your God." This is talking, of course, about cross-dressing, it may not be talking exactly about what we would call a transvestite, where someone actually is impersonating a member of the opposite sex. It would include that, certainly. But it might be, I think that's basically the spirit of what this command is. I mean, there are Christians, even in modern times, who reading this verse say, well, women shouldn't wear pants because that's what pertains to a man. Women shouldn't cut their hair because short hair pertains to a man. Men should not wear long hair because that pertains to a woman. Men should not wear earrings because that pertains to a woman, and so forth. Obviously, all of those statements would have been true at a certain point in our cultural history. There was a time when only men wore pants and women always wore dresses. And I don't know who the first woman was to start wearing pants, but the first woman who did was, in fact, wearing that which pertains to a man. And no doubt that would have been a violation of this. However, what clothing items or hairstyles pertain to a man or a woman is something that varies from culture to culture. God, for instance, doesn't say, such and such garments always will pertain to men, and such garments will always pertain to women. After all, they didn't even have pants in those days. Everyone wore robes or they had skirts of their garments and so forth. It is simply a matter of culture as to what culture views as male or female attire. And there was a time, as I said, when if a woman put on pants, that would have been considered a male's garment because only men wore them. Today, however, it's quite obvious that culturally, a woman who puts on a pair of pants is not necessarily trying to be masculine in doing so, because it's now accepted woman's garb. The same thing could be said of earrings on men, and possibly of longer hair on men than was once considered, you know, acceptable. When I was a kid, if a man's hair touched the top of his ear, you know, he's pretty radical. When the Beatles came out, everyone was scandalized by their long hair. I don't know if any of you were around or old enough to recall how it was such a scandal to the older generation that the Beatles had such long hair. Well, if you can see a picture of the Beatles today of how they came, how it was, there's not a person here who has hair shorter than the Beatles' hair was then. And none of you here, very few anyway, would be viewed as having long hair. I'm talking about you men. You know, I mean, some of you have hair a little longer than the average, but I mean, culture changes. Now, when Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11 that women shouldn't cut their hair and men shouldn't have long hair, it's a shame to them to do so, and when he said that women should cover their heads and so forth, there's some question as to whether he was talking about eternal verities, transcendent realities, or whether he's talking about cultural norms. And, you know, no doubt some of you have one opinion and some another on that question, as to whether Paul was talking about that which was merely cultural or that which was transcendent and eternal. But whether you hold to one or another view, it is absolutely, in my understanding, impossible to nail down one or the other. I mean, there's simply not enough material on it in 1 Corinthians 11. Some feel that Paul is talking about things that must transcend culture, and that women should always wear their hair long, men should always wear their hair short, and women should always wear a head covering when praying or prophesying. Frankly, I have no objection to people doing that. But as far as whether that's a universal thing that has spiritual ramifications in itself, and therefore should be practiced by all generations and all cultures, on the one hand, or whether, on the other hand, it is simply Paul saying to the Corinthians, don't dress and wear your hair in the way that your culture regards as violating your gender roles. If in Corinth it was understood that, you know, women normally did not cut their hair and they wore coverings on their heads, and men normally did not wear their hair long, and that is the case, of course, it was the case in Corinth, Paul may have been saying nothing more than don't violate your cultural norms of dress for your gender. That for a man to have long hair would be considered shameful in that culture, therefore, it's a shame for him to do so. For a woman to have her hair cut would be equally shameful in that culture. Or for her to pray or prophesy without her head covering. Therefore, don't unnecessarily violate your cultural norms. Unless, of course, they would be in themselves immodest or something. I know that people have different views on this. My personal view about the head covering issue, and I'm open to being changed, but I've looked at as much evidence as I can find. I hope to find more to settle the matter. But I think that Paul was mainly concerned about this very issue that's raised in Deuteronomy 22, verse 5. That a woman shouldn't wear that which is culturally recognized as male clothing. And a man should not wear that which is culturally regarded as female clothing. The head coverings, we know from history, were something that the Greeks culturally, they followed the very practices that Paul is advocating. Even the non-Christian Greeks did. Therefore, it wasn't strictly a spiritual thing. It was something that was cultural, and it may have also been spiritual, but whether it had spiritual ramifications beyond the question of whether women were choosing to violate the normal dress codes for their gender, which was, in a sense, a violation of their sexual identity or a refusal, a rebellion against it, I don't know. One thing we do know for sure, because it's stated frequently in the Scripture, is that God is opposed to people rebelling against their sexual identity. To say, well, I'm a male, but I was really intended to be a female. And there are people who say that. There are people who say, I'm really a female in a male's body. And some people go so far, as we know, to have actual sex changes surgically and everything, because that's what they think about themselves. That is nothing less than rebellion against God's sovereignty. It's quite obvious that God didn't put any males in female bodies or females in male bodies. And homosexuality and similar deviations of rebellion against one's sexual identity, which would include transvestites, you know, dressing up in drag like the opposite sex, or people actually going so far as to have sex change would be the ultimate, you know, rebellion against their sexual identity. Those things are an abomination to God. And I think that what Paul, what Moses is saying here, and what Paul is building upon in 1 Corinthians 11, is that God wants us to accept the gender that He created us to be, and to submit to His decision in the matter. There are men who envy women. There are women who envy men. And there are both who seek to obliterate role distinctions between the two and try to just make everyone, you know, unisex. This is apparently the kind of thing that God is concerned about here. Now, for a man to wear an earring today, I mean, it's a male style in some among certain parts of our culture. I will never wear an earring, and I don't particularly like earrings, but I don't think there's anything wrong with a man today choosing to wear an earring, since that is something that is recognized as something men do without seeking to be effeminate. There was a time, of course, not too many years back, when a man wearing an earring would, you know, you'd look at him strange because only women wore earrings. I have not yet seen, for instance, the wearing of makeup become a male fashion. I hope it never does. The first man who starts wearing lipstick and makeup is going to be in violation of this scripture. 100 years from now, or 50 years from now, however, if all men are wearing makeup, and it's not considered distinctively what pertains to a female, but it's just like pants are today. I mean, men and women, it's considered to be a style that is, you know, it doesn't, it's not restricted to one sex. Then it'd be a different matter. But the important thing, I think, the thing here is that when a person puts on clothing which he knows to be and intends to be the clothing that belongs to the opposite sex in order to rebel against their sexual identity. And that is something that homosexuals do, that transvestites do, that those who are transsexuals who have operations do. Of course, I don't think they had the technology for any kind of transsexuals to exist in ancient Israel. But that was sort of like taking this principle to the extreme, which our culture does because of its excessive rebellion. This is an abomination to God. Verse 6, if a bird's nest happens to be before you along the way, in any tree or on the ground, which with the young ones or the eggs, with the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall surely let the mother go and take the young for yourself, that it may be well with you and that you may prolong your days. Now, it's a strange law, and there may be some kind of ethical or spiritual concept underlying it. If so, I don't know what that concept is. We do know that there were times when God gave laws that sounded like they had to do merely with animal rights, things like don't muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. It sounds like just a law that has to do with observing the rights of your animals or the care of your animals, where in fact the Apostle Paul quotes that twice in the New Testament as having a spiritual meaning. It is possible that a law like this one, which also seems to be concerned about the welfare of an animal, may, in God's mind, be intended to convey some spiritual meaning, but if so, I haven't gotten the revelation about it yet. As far as the practical reason behind a law like this, it would seem that if you find a mother bird sitting on eggs or on young, and you certainly have the right to eat the bird, I mean, if it's not an unclean bird, you're in luck. You don't have to hunt. You've stumbled across your prey, and you can take it. But if you take the mother and the young, then it could be in the sense that if you do that very frequently, you're going to destroy another generation of birds coming along. You're going to prevent there from being enough birds in the next generation. Better if you've got two generations of birds before you. Take the new generation, because if you just take the mother and leave the young are going to die anyway. The eggs won't hatch, and you know, you might as well have taken both. If you take the young and eat those, go ahead and let the mother go. She can reproduce, and it won't cancel out another generation coming about. The idea is to seemingly avoid wastefulness in the use of resources, animal or other resources. Just like when the laws were given about warfare in chapter 20, it said don't cut down all the fruit trees. You know, cut down trees that aren't good for fruit. But the idea seems to have some, you know, environmentalist concern behind it. And I don't say that the modern environmental movement has very much in common with God. As a matter of fact, many times its presuppositions are more New Age or you know, otherwise, you know, not agreeable with what we would generally think. Yet, the fact is that man is given a stewardship over the earth and that all that is in it. And there is a sense in which man should show a bit of wisdom in his use of those resources. There's a similar law back in Leviticus encountered earlier in chapter 22. Leviticus 22:28, which says, whether it is a cow or a ewe, do not kill both her and her young on the same day. Again, a kind of a strange law. And there may be some hidden spiritual meaning that the Holy Spirit will make known to you. He has not made known to me, at least at this point. But it also sounds a lot like this law about the birds. Don't kill both generations the same day. Save some for the next generation. Allow this, you know, eat what you need, but don't kill wholesale to satisfy, you know, a craving for food that you'll regret later when there isn't enough food later because you've killed off both generations at once. It seems to, again, as I say, there may be something spiritual behind it, but even without any spiritual meaning, it does show some concern for moderate use of resources, and particularly a kind of use of resources that allows for them to be renewed. A concern for the renewing of usable resources. So it may be a stewardship issue largely, how we steward the animals and plants that God has given to us for our good. Verse 8, when you build a new house, then you shall make a parapet, or like a rail around the roof, like a wall, so that you may not bring blood guiltiness on your house if anyone falls from it. Now, it seems strange to our culture, because people aren't usually wandering around on the roofs in our culture, and it wouldn't be easy to do so since we have sloped roofs, but they had flat roofs in those days, and because their houses only had small windows, and it was a hot culture, they had to have the windows small so thieves couldn't come in. They didn't have glass windows, and they didn't have screens such as we do, so in order to get out of the hot house, they'd go up and sit on top of the roof, especially in the evening times, and there'd be sort of like the living room of the house would be up on the roof. And if there's no ridge around the roof, like a little stem wall or something around it, people could easily fall off, and if they fall and break their neck and die, it's your fault. This is a law that establishes the concept of criminal negligence, that you can become guilty of manslaughter involuntarily simply by your negligence. And, of course, there are laws that reflect the same awareness today. It's not always what you do deliberately. If you damage somebody by a hostile attack upon them and kill them, of course, that's first-degree murder. If an axe head falls off the axe handle and hits them in the head, and you had no idea that the axe head was loose, and you kill somebody that way, that was not considered to be first-degree murder. It was a form of manslaughter, but it was allowed. You were free of guilt from that. If you fled to the city of refuge, you could live there. If, however, you killed somebody without malice, but simply because you were negligent of ordinary carefulness, that you allowed your property to have a pit dug in it, which people fell into in the dark and broke their necks, and you didn't, you know, cover the pit, that is, fill it up or put a fence around it or something. If you had an animal that was hostile and it gored somebody, this was considered to be punishable by death. You would be guilty of murder. You know the laws. We read them back in Exodus, that if a man has an animal that gores a man, and it was known before that it was an aggressive animal and he hadn't kept it penned up, well, then he's considered a murderer because it was criminal negligence on his part. Likewise here, if you don't build a little rail around the top of your house and one of your neighbors is over visiting, you know, leans off or falls off and gets hurt, you're responsible as if you had done an aggressive act of murder against him. It's criminal negligence, and that's what this is talking about here. Verse 9, you shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of the vineyard be defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as wool and linen mixed together. Now, these three verses I read together because they all seem to have the same kind of principle behind them. And here, I do believe we can see spiritual meaning behind it. I mean, to wear clothing of mixed linen and wool doesn't seem to really have moral ramifications, although I have heard people say, I have never really seen the research in scientific journals on this or done any experiments to prove it. I've heard people say that it is known that when you wear wool and cotton together, does something to your vitality, and it saps energy or something. I mean, I've heard that. I don't know if that's a New Age teaching or if that's something scientists have tried. I certainly wouldn't want to stand by it. And I also don't believe that the law is given because of any such considerations. I believe here we have three laws that have one basic meaning behind them. And that is that you don't mix together those things that are fundamentally unalike. Now, it's not so important to us who now are not under the law to be sure to observe the letter of this law, but we should have some idea of what the law was given for, what it was trying to convey spiritually. Fortunately, we have some New Testament information on this, because the statement in verse 10, "You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together," almost certainly underlies Paul's statement in 2 Corinthians 6, where he gives a spiritual meaning to it and gives us sort of the key to unlocking the spiritual meaning of these three laws. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. Paul says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God." Now, where Paul says don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, he's saying you don't put yourself and an unbeliever under the same yoke, as when plowing a field, one puts two animals under one yoke. The unbeliever is unclean. You are clean. What fellowship is there between that which is unclean and that which is clean? That which is righteous and that which is unrighteous? That which is idolatrous and that which is devoted to God? That which is light and that which is darkness? The ox and the ass represent the clean and the unclean. The ox was a clean animal, the donkey an unclean animal. And Paul seems to take this principle. You don't put an unclean and a clean animal together under one yoke to do a job together. And he applies it spiritually. You don't put a Christian and a non-Christian, a clean and an unclean person, under the same yoke to pull a weight or to do a job. So Paul gives a spiritual application to this, and therefore, to my mind, gives us a key to understand all three of these laws, which have seemingly the same basic principle behind them. Namely, do not match things that are unlike, that which are fundamentally unlike. And the application is in the realm of the spiritual. Don't match things that are spiritually unalike. Don't link them together. Now, this concept has been suggested earlier, for instance, in chapter 12, when he says, "Now don't go in and ask yourself how these nations worship their God and try to bring those practices into the worship of your God." That would be, of course, a violation of this very principle, trying to bring things that are unalike spiritually, pagan religious practices, and syncretizing them with Judaism. Not allowed to do that. Things that are God's are holy. They are separate. They are different fundamentally than things that are not God's. There are the common things and the holy things. Christians are holy people. An ox was a clean animal, a donkey an unclean animal. Now, as far as the different kinds of cloth, wearing them together, or different kinds of grains in the field, while I don't know that we could say one kind of grain is clean and another unclean, or one kind of cloth is clean and another is unclean, it is interesting that it says in Ezekiel, concerning the praises, in Ezekiel 44, verse 18, Ezekiel 44, 18 says, "Their garments should be of cotton, of linen, and they should wear no wool or anything that causes sweat." Ezekiel 44, 18. Now, this itself may be symbolic. The priest is not supposed to be sweating at the altar. Maybe because he shouldn't have a foul body odor at the altar, but also maybe because it suggests perspiration goes with human effort, human work. It's part of the curse. In the sweat of your face, you should earn your bread. Whereas Christians are supposed to be resting in the Lord and not sweating in their service of God. But that may or may not be an application intended in Ezekiel. The interesting thing, though, is that linen or cotton was what the priest was to wear. He was not to wear wool. So in a sense, wool, which was forbidden for the priest to wear, would have been a common cloth that anyone could wear, but the priests were supposed to wear linen. Again, make a distinction between that which was holy and that which was common. And therefore, you're not supposed to mix them. And as far as the seeds are concerned, the mixing of diverse seeds can destroy the whole crop, it suggests, or defile the whole vineyard. We don't have an exact parallel to that in the New Testament, except we do have, of course, the parable of the wheat and the tares that were both sown in the same field, which was an undesirable situation. And that the wheat, of course, was the children of the kingdom, and the tares were the children of the wicked one. Again, mixing those things that are not alike in the same field. Now, he doesn't give exactly that illustration here. But I think that the principle that God is trying to educate the Jews about here through symbolic laws that seem to have only to do with agriculture and what you wear, really was that God has made some things fundamentally unalike, and they should not be mixed. And the spiritual fulfillment of that is that you should not try to mix that which God has made holy, spiritually speaking, with that which is common or which is fundamentally spiritually of a different class. And that's what I understand to be the meaning of these laws. Verse 12. You shall make tassels on the four corners of your clothing with which you cover yourself. This was covered earlier in Numbers 15, verses 37 through 41. We won't talk about that again. Okay. Now, we come to the subject of the evidence of virginity. It says in verse 13, if any man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her and charges her with shameful conduct and brings a bad name on her and says, I took this woman when I came to her and I found she was not a virgin. Obviously, she represented herself as a virgin when they got married. But when he marries her, he finds out she's not a virgin, or at least accuses her of not being a virgin. This would, of course, free him from any obligation to the marriage and even, as it turns out, would subject her to being stoned. As one who had played the harlot in her father's house. Then the father and mother of the young woman shall take and bring out the evidence of the young man of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the gate of the city. Now, some of the questions that you turned in about Deuteronomy had to do with this. What are the evidences of virginity? And it is not stated specifically, and therefore we don't know exactly by what means a girl's virginity was proved in early Israelite society. In other ancient societies, and we know, for instance, there were, in some cases, chastity belts that women wore until married, which would, of course, prevent them from having sexual intercourse prior to marriage. And if in this case they had such, then the chastity belt would itself be a proof that the woman had remained a virgin, and the parents would have kept that in their house in order to vindicate her name if she were accused otherwise. It doesn't seem like that's the most likely evidence of virginity that's intended. I think most commentators would agree that it's probably a reference to bed sheets, which were used on the wedding night, which, if the woman was a virgin, would have blood stains on them. I've heard that in some Arab cultures, when a couple gets married, they go into the tent, and the whole family sits outside waiting for the couple to consummate, and the family doesn't go away until they hand the bloody bed sheets out of the tent. And the family goes off carrying the bloody bed sheets to prove that the girl was a virgin. And I've heard that in some cases, just to get the relatives to go away, they kill a chicken in there and get the chicken's blood on the sheets and just hand out the blood sheet, and then they have their time to themselves. But I don't know where this is practiced, but I understand that this has been done in some cultures. At any rate, the parents would keep these tokens of the girl's virginity just for such a time as this, that she might be falsely accused of not having been a virgin. And so if a man brings this charge against the girl, the parents are supposed to bring out the proof that she is innocent of this charge. In verse 16, the young woman's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as a wife, and he detests her. Now he charges her with shameful conduct, saying, I found your daughter was not a virgin. And yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. Now, the cloth, obviously, sounds like it may be the bed sheet or something like that. Then the elders of that city shall take the man and punish him. And they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman because he brought a bad name on a virgin of Israel, and she shall be his wife. He cannot divorce her all of his days. But if the thing is true, and evidence of virginity are not found for the young woman, Then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house. The men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel, to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil person from among you. Now, I'm a little bothered by this legislation, just because it seems to violate, but I don't think it does. I think it must just be an exception. The principle that if a man brings a false accusation against a person, then the punishment that person would have received if found guilty, but since they are found evident, they are found evidence that they're innocent, that punishment would be inflicted on the accuser. Now, it's obvious if this accusation against the girl is correct and found to be correct, she's put to death. If, however, it is found to be a false accusation, it seems to me like the man who made the accusation should be put to death under the law that says a false witness should receive the punishment that his victim would have received. It seems like since the penalty for this girl would be death, if she is falsely accused by her husband of it, he should be put to death. Now, here an exception is made. He is not put to death. He is penalized financially. He has to give something to the father for having ruined the family's good name. Has to give him a good amount of money. And he also has lost any right to divorce his wife. Now, it suggests by this that there might have been other grounds for divorce, which if he had not brought such false charges against her, he might have on some occasion been able to divorce her on some other grounds. But having brought these false charges against her, he has now basically forfeited any right he might have in the future to divorce her for any cause whatsoever. And this was his penalty. Now, one might say it's not very fair that if she's found guilty, she's put to death, but if she's found innocent, he isn't put to death. But this may be because if he was put to death, she'd be a widow, and it would be hard on her. It would actually hurt her more. Now, you might say, well, I'd rather be a widow than live with a man who's trying to get me put to death on false charges. But that's our culture. That was theirs. Actually, almost anything was to be chosen rather than dying a widow or being childless for a woman. I mean, to have children, to be an old maid or a widow, and to not have children, to care for her in old age and so forth, was simply to be not only a great disgrace, but also a great misfortune on a woman. And again, people weren't married for purposes of love, unfortunately, in those days. I don't know if that's fortunate or not. In our society, people do marry for love, and they divorce more frequently. I don't know. You know, maybe marriages that weren't made for love lasted better and longer, because the presuppositions and the expectations were of a different sort in those marriages. But anyway, I'd rather not marry someone I didn't love myself. But since the women didn't necessarily grow up thinking, I'm going to be in love with the man I marry, you know, they just knew, someday I'm going to marry and have kids. The fact that this man was a scoundrel and lied about her and so forth might have not made that big a difference to her. She still would want to have a husband and have children. Having a bad husband was not all that uncommon and perhaps not considered to be the ultimate misfortune. So, in this case, the man would be spared his life, though penalized. And since he had brought charges falsely against his wife, his penalty was now he can never divorce her, which is exactly what he was trying to do. He was trying to put her out, trying to bring her out from under his house. Now he can't do that. He has to support her and be her husband and, you know, give her children and so forth, all the ordinary things a husband would do, regardless of her behavior after this. Presumably, even if she went out and, well, no, if she committed adultery, she'd be put to death, so that's a different situation. At any rate, that's what this is talking about. A man makes false charges. Now you might say, no, wait, why would the woman be put to death, even if it was found that she'd lost her virginity earlier? After all, there is a law that says if a virgin and a man sleep together, and she's not married or betrothed, she would not be put to death for that. She would just have to marry the man, you recall. And so why should she be put to death at a later date? It was found she had done just that. She'd slept with someone before she was married. Well, the answer to that would be probably twofold. One is that under the law, if she had slept with someone before she was married, she was supposed to marry the guy. Instead, she didn't. She concealed it and deceived the man she actually did marry into thinking that she was a virgin. That puts her in a slightly different category than one who does sleep with a man and then marries him under the penalty of the law. And it is also the case that if she comes into the marriage bed not a virgin, she could not prove that her previous sexual encounter had been prior to her betrothal. Because if she had slept with another man during her betrothal period, it was the same as adultery. The only way that she could get away with her life, having lost her virginity, would be if it was prior to her being betrothed that she did so. In which case, the law said she should marry the man she slept with. We're talking about a situation where that actually hasn't happened. She has slept with somebody before the marriage, but it can't be proven that it was prior to her betrothal. Nor did she marry the man that she slept with. Because the man she now marries was unaware of her previous activities. So, obviously, she's not in the same category. It has to be assumed that she may be guilty of having slept with the man after her betrothal because she has shown herself to be a deceiver anyway. Can't trust her testimony on it. She entered into marriage on the pretense of being a virgin and was not. And therefore, the worst has to be assumed in order to keep sin from running rampant in the land. So, that's how that law takes care of that situation. Verse 22, we get back to something that does talk about what we encountered in Exodus, about a man and a woman sleeping together who are not married, and then later those who are, or actually the other first. If a man is found lying with a woman, verse 22, married to a husband, then both of them shall die, both the man that lay with the woman and the woman. So you shall put away the evil person from Israel. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city, and you shall stone them to death with stones, and the young woman because she did not cry out in the city, and the man because he humbled his neighbor's wife, so you shall put away the evil person from among you. But if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die, but you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin worthy of death. For just as when a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so is it in this matter. Known as an act of aggression and victimization. For he found her in the countryside, and the betrothed young woman cried out, and there was no one to save her. Now there's three things mentioned here. First of all, you catch somebody in the act of adultery. A man and a woman who are married, and therefore it is straightforward adultery. They're caught in the act, which means that they were not in some isolated place. There were people around. Someone was around to find them. Both are to be killed. It's interesting that in John chapter 8, we read of a woman who is brought to Jesus who is said to have been caught in the very act of adultery, and the Pharisees who caught her want to have her stoned. But if she's caught in the very act of adultery, then the man must have been caught there too, because a woman can't be in the act of adultery if the man is not present. And yet they didn't bring the man. They let him off the hook. So it shows that the Jews had sort of practiced a double standard contrary to their own law. They let a man get away with it, but not a woman. Whereas the law itself gave no advantage to the man in this situation. The man and woman both should be put to death. Then it moves to a situation where the woman is not married yet, but she is betrothed, and therefore her status is as if she were married. There is a difference between a virgin who's not betrothed and one who is in the law. A virgin who's not betrothed is available, and if the man sleeps with her, he has to marry her. If she's betrothed, she's not available. She's spoken for as if she were married, and therefore it's like adultery. Now, the distinction here is, here's two different possible cases where a betrothed girl sleeps with someone other than her husband. One is in the city and one's out in the countryside. If it happens in the city, she is considered to be guilty of adultery because in the city it is presumed there's enough people around she could have called out for help, and she didn't. Therefore, she must be, at some level, consenting, and therefore guilty. If it happened in the countryside, of course, she still might be consenting, but you give her the benefit of the doubt. Even if she had cried out for help in the countryside, there's no one around, and therefore, you give her the benefit of the doubt that she did cry out. Now, see, there's always a possibility that she was consenting even then, but you couldn't prove it. And therefore, the law wants to err on the side of mercy in this case and say, well, she may well have cried out and been, no one was around to help her, so we'll give her the benefit of the doubt that she did not consent to this, and we'll treat it as a case of aggression and victimization, the same as murder. And therefore, only the man will be put to death and not the girl who will be given the benefit of the doubt that she's a victim here. Verse 28, if a man finds a young woman who is a virgin, who is not betrothed, here's the fourth situation, and seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver. She shall be his wife because he has humbled her, and he shall not be permitted to divorce her all of his days. This is just a repetition of Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17, which the same law stated, but a couple details added here. In Exodus it just said he shall marry her. And if the father won't let him marry her, then he'll have to pay to the father the price of virgins. Does not specify what that price is. Here it is, he has to pay the price and marry her. The price is designated as 50 shekels of silver. And it is also added he can't divorce her here. Because he stepped out of bounds here. He loses the option of divorce, which ordinarily exists in a marriage in the Old Testament. Not much more to say about that. Verse 30, it says, a man shall not take his father's wife nor uncover his father's bed. This should go without saying that a man would not sleep with his mother or his stepmother. However, that isn't the way, I mean, there are people who are perverted enough to do that. Reuben, for example, slept with his father's concubine. Absalom also slept with David's concubines publicly in order to show that he had displaced his father to the whole city. And even in the New Testament, we find in the Christian church in Corinth, in chapter 5, there was a man living with his father's mother in a sinful relationship. So we can see that the law needed to be stated because some people would actually do this if not told not to, and some did it even when told not to. I can't imagine wanting to sleep with, my father's wife, whether it were my mother or my stepmother, but apparently there's some people who are not, I guess to them nothing is sacred. Okay, chapter 23. Here we have a list of persons who are not permitted to enter into the sanctuary. Presumably this means they can't go to the tabernacle or later to the temple. He who is emasculated by crushing or mutilation shall not enter the congregation of the Lord. Now, mutilation would simply be a case where someone has been deliberately made a eunuch. Somebody who perhaps is in the king's cabinet, and in those days frequently such persons were made eunuchs deliberately. If it's by crushing, presumably that would be by accident. There's some kind of an injury there. But if by any means the person was emasculated, that is castrated or made, lost the use of his sexual organs, then he is not permitted to come into the sanctuary of the Lord. Likewise, verse 2, one of illegitimate birth shall not enter the congregation of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the congregation of the Lord. An Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the congregation of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the congregation of the Lord forever. Because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Peor, from Bethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. Nevertheless, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. You shall not seek their peace nor their prosperity all the days of your life, forever. You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you are an alien in his land. The children of the third generation born to them, that is Egyptians and Edomites, may enter the congregation of the Lord. That is, if they're proselytes, if a person has a Jewish parent and an Egyptian parent, or a Jewish parent and an Edomite parent, they could not enter the congregation of the Lord, but their great-grandchildren could. If the parentage was Moabite or Ammonite, you'd have to wait 10 generations. In fact, 10 generations may just be a way of saying forever, because the word forever is used at the end of verse 3. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the congregation of the Lord forever. 10 generations may just be a way of saying, forever. However, the third generation is a shorter period of time, and after 3 generations they can. Now, there's several things to comment on here. First of all, why? I mean, why would God pick on somebody who had been made a eunuch or had been injured in his stones, as the King James says? Why would God pick on an illegitimate child? It wasn't his fault. Or a person who had a Moabite or an Ammonite parent somewhere in his ancestry. Or an Edomite or an Egyptian grandfather. I mean, why would God pick on these people? It's quite obvious that the Bible teaches that such people can be saved. The restriction is not from the kingdom of God, but from the sanctuary. And it was not necessary that a person had to go to the sanctuary in order to be saved. A man is saved by faith, not by going to the sanctuary. But excluding these people from the sanctuary was to symbolize something. And I believe what it was to symbolize was some spiritual reality. The Moabites were the enemies of God. of God's people. The Edomites and Egyptians had been unfriendly too, to a certain extent, but apparently not to the same degree, or at least was not considered to be the same culpability level. And therefore, there was some restriction on those who were God's enemies, in general, from approaching the Lord. To do harm to God's people is to alienate yourself from fellowship with God. Now, a man who'd lost his use of his reproductive organs is a man who could not bear fruit. And I think that this would... Isaiah 56 is a prophecy that predicts the coming of the new covenant, however, in language that would be understandable to the old covenant people. The opening verses of Isaiah 56 read like this: Thus says the Lord, keep justice and do righteousness, for my salvation is about to come, and my righteousness is to be revealed. Blessed is the man who does this, and the son of man who lays hold on it, who keeps from defiling the Sabbath, and keeps his hand from doing any evil. Do not let the son of a foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, the Lord has utterly separated me from his people. Nor let the eunuch say, here I am a dry tree, a fruitless tree. For thus says the Lord to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbath and choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, even to them I will give in my house and within my walls a place and a name better than of sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Also the sons of the foreigner who joins himself, the Gentile who joins himself to the Lord, doesn't say necessarily to Israel, but to the Lord, to serve him, and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants. Everyone who keeps from defiling the Sabbath and holds fast my covenant, even them I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house forever. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations. Jesus quoted that, as you know, about his own time. And the Lord God who gathers the outcast of Israel says, yet I will gather to him others besides those who are gathered. And that is Gentiles as well as Jews. Jesus himself said, I have other sheep you don't know about. I'm going to go to them and bring them in too to the same fold. God will gather others, that is Gentiles, besides those who are gathered, the Jews. Now, this whole passage is a prediction of the new covenant, fulfilled, of course, from the time of Christ unto the present. And the concept, though it is fraught with a bunch of references to Jewish practices like Sabbath keeping and burnt offerings and things like that, those are just the forms of worship understood by the Jew. We know in the New Testament those things give place to spiritual Sabbath keeping and spiritual sacrifices. But the concept is that those persons who would be excluded by the law from being God's people, eunuchs, whom Deuteronomy would exclude from the fellowship with God, foreigners who are Gentiles, they're no longer to talk about being excluded. They can come right in. They can have a place that is actually better than that of the sons and the daughters. That is, of Jews, if those Jews happen to be unbelievers. Eunuchs and Gentiles will have a place in it. And this is simply predicting what we now know and take for granted, that anybody can be one of God's people by faith, by taking hold of his covenant. And his house, the church, is a house of prayer for all nations, not just for Israel. A building in Jerusalem. Okay, well, we see then that though the law would exclude a eunuch, Isaiah predicted a time when being a eunuch would be no disadvantage with reference to a fellowship with God, because God was bringing a different covenant. The law was the old covenant. The old covenant excluded certain people from being God's people. The new covenant includes those people. The new covenant extends the right to a greater, broader populace to be God's people. And that is, of course, what we, again, know without being told now in the new covenant. It would follow the same as true of Moabites and so forth. David is a good example of God's grace transcending the law, even in Old Testament times. I mean, he went into the temple and ate the showbread, which the law forbade him to do. He was the offspring of a Moabite and was able to approach the Lord. I mean, many things about David's life violate the ceremonial law. And David, who is a type of Christ... His story is a good one to show us that even in Old Testament times, God was more concerned about mercy than sacrifice, more concerned about the spiritual than the ritual. And of course, that ritual is done away altogether in Christ. Now back to Deuteronomy 23, verse 9. When the army goes out against your enemies, and keep yourself from every wicked thing. Now, this apparently, these verses have to do with actually the encampment of the armies out on the battlefield, how to keep things clean. When you're at home and you've got your wash basins and your disposal systems and so forth, it's easier to maintain sanitary conditions. When you're on a camp out, then you have to decide what to do about, you know, what you're going to do about your feces and so forth. And so there's, and to make sure that, you know, the camp doesn't get defiled. And so, here's a few examples given. It says, if there is any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, I think all commentators would agree that this occurrence in the night refers to a wet dream, then he shall go outside the camp and shall not come inside the camp, but it shall be when evening comes, then he shall wash himself with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp again. Also, you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out to defecate, actually. And you shall have an implement among your equipment, and when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn and cover your refuse. For the Lord your God walks in the midst of the camp. I don't like to walk in my yard when a dog's been there and left his refuse around, and I don't think God wants to walk around where there's human refuse laying around. I mean, there's the imagery is that God's walking around. He doesn't want to, well, you know, he wants that stuff buried out of sight. But the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give your enemies over to you. Therefore, your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. Now, a couple things. I don't know why this would be particularly applicable to encampments on the wet dream issue, but we know from other places in Scripture that a woman who had an issue of blood or a man who had a seminal discharge, that is, he was leaking semen, just like a woman would leak blood. That was an unusual occurrence. It was something that is not, you know, normal, and it would temporarily defile a person, make him unclean. Even if that discharge was simply something that occurred during the night, he'd be temporarily unclean. He'd wash himself and be clean the next evening. But this, in a sense, may help to give us some way of assessing the question of masturbation, which we don't usually use that word in mixed company, but it's a real word, it's a real practice. Christians struggle with it just like anyone else does, and Christians especially struggle with the question, is it okay? And the answer would seem to be, no, it isn't okay. Now, different Christians give different answers to that, but I believe it's not okay, and part of the reason would be this, that a seminal discharge that is not a part of marital sexual intercourse is something that ceremonially defiled man. Now, he's not held guilty of it. It's not like it's a sin that he had a wet dream. I mean, he probably couldn't help that. He might wish he hadn't had it. He didn't choose it. And therefore, again, it's like leprosy or anything else that makes a man ceremonially unclean. It's a type that represents the effects of sin. It isn't a sin itself. But the type is supposed to mean something. And a discharge like that would make a man ceremonially unclean. It's interesting when the Apostle Paul lists certain works of the flesh and things that defile a man. One of the things that comes up, one of the words that comes up a lot is uncleanness. Have you ever noticed that in reading Paul's list? He says, let none of these things be heard among you. Uncleanness, fornication, adultery, idolatry, and so forth. Uncleanness is listed as a separate sin. You'd think that any sin was uncleanness. And so it raises the question, what does he mean by uncleanness? And I don't know that I could say, but it's crossed my mind that since this kind of thing made a man in the Old Testament ceremonially unclean, that Paul, especially since he lists uncleanness frequently in the list with fornication and adultery and so forth, may be thinking along the lines of masturbation. I at least would not want to take my chances on it being otherwise. So I would say that, you know, while we don't find any direct reference to masturbation in the Bible, and that silence has given some people a sense of, well, we've got liberty to do that, I think there are some factors and some principles that would weigh against it as a legitimate practice among Christians, and this may be one of them. Another thing about covering their excrement, covering their feces out in the field, you might think, well, a common decency would cause someone to do that. But again, what we call common decency is a social conscience that's been affected very strongly by biblical norms for centuries. And of course, any person raised in the Western world would think, of course you're going to, you know, bury it if you do it out in the field. But in some countries that aren't affected by scriptures, that's not well known. If you go to Asian refugee camps, or even not even refugee camps, some parts of Asia, people just defecate at the side of the road and leave it there. There are some places where feces and urine run down the middle of the street in third world countries. I mean, there seems to be no awareness innate in mankind, without being informed by God, or at least by science, one way or the other, that this is unsanitary and harmful, and just plain offensive. I mean, they must know by instinct that it's offensive. But you would think that anyone would know that it's an unclean thing to have human urine and feces running through the streets or laying at the side of the road or whatever. But apparently that's not something that people know instinctively. The reason we know it instinctively is because we come from a culture that for a long time has been very much aware of the standards of Scripture. And it's something that in ancient times, apparently, people didn't always do this. Other armies other than the Israelites would just poop on the ground and leave the piles, you know. And God says, you can't do that. Now, God didn't explain the hygienic reasons for it. He spoke of it more as something that's sort of ceremonially defiling. But like so many things that God forbade without giving an explanation, later scientific discovery or knowledge has made it clear that there, whether it was the main reason or not, there's good, sound, hygienic reasons for what God commanded, and we can see that to be the case with this too. We've got to move along. Verse 15. You shall not give back to his master the slave who has escaped from his master to you. He may dwell with you in your midst, in the place which he chooses within one of your gates, where it seems best to him. You shall not oppress him. Now, we're not told why this is, and it does seem strange in view of the fact that a previous law we just read said you should give back to your neighbor anything of his that runs away, and we do know that slaves were considered property. But this law makes it clear that slaves were considered to be a different class of property because they were human. Because they were human, you should not give them back. Now, that doesn't mean that slaves were permitted to run away. A man who sold himself into slavery out of justice should not run away from his master. Usually he was a slave because he had a debt and he couldn't pay it, and therefore he paid his debt by becoming a slave. To run away from his master would be to default on that payment of that debt, and therefore an injustice on his part. And a Christian who was a slave in the New Testament was told not to run away and not to seek to escape his obligation as a slave. In fact, Philemon owned a slave. He was a Christian man. His slave's name was Onesimus. And that slave was not a Christian and ran away. And he found Paul in Rome just by some providence. And Paul led Onesimus to the Lord. And though Paul couldn't force Onesimus to go back to his master, he counseled him to. He said, you know, now that you're a Christian, you need to make restitution. You should go back to your master. And he persuaded Onesimus to go turn himself in. And he sent the letter, which we call Philemon, in our Bible, along with him, so that his master might show him some compassion and mercy. And apparently, Onesimus did go back, or else the letter probably would never have been preserved. A slave should not run away from his master, but if one does and happens to come to you, you should keep him. And maybe this is something that our own society needs to pay close attention to at this very moment. As recently as last week, and probably still happening, our government is sending Haitian refugees back to Haiti. Many of them say they're fleeing from political persecution. And there are some reports that the ones that we are repatriating against their will, as we not let them come in, we're sending them back, that some of them are being tortured and killed. Now, the State Department of our country says there's no evidence that they're being tortured and killed. These rumors are unsubstantiated and so forth. And they say these people are not political refugees. They are economic refugees. They're just coming here because there's a better standard of living and they don't like living in poverty. And I guess our nation has had a policy that anyone who's a political refugee fleeing for his life can come here. But if they just want a higher standard of living and they don't like living in a third world country and want to live in a wealthy country, the immigration is a little more difficult. And so there's some question about what the nature of these refugees is. Are they political or economic refugees? Well, our government has decided that many of them are economic refugees merely. They're sending them back. They're not allowing these runaway slaves, we could say, if you're running from a slave state. If you're a refugee from an oppressive master, whether that master is an owner of slaves or a government official, it seems to me like the law of Moses says, let them stay. Don't send them back. And And we've, of course, our country has had a flood of refugees come up from Latin America in recent times, from places like Nicaragua and El Salvador, because of war situations. And our country has not always had wide open doors for these people. There has been some influx allowed, but a lot of people are sent back. I personally am ashamed of the fact that our government doesn't take them in. Now, of course, the arguments are, we already have enough unemployed people of our own citizens. We need to look out for them first. These illegal aliens would come in and take the jobs, and then our own people don't have jobs. Well, listen, most of these illegal aliens take jobs that no citizens want. They live in migrant worker camps. They pick fruit and often don't get even minimum wage. And they're not taking jobs away from healthy American citizens. The unemployed in America sometimes can't find jobs, but sometimes they're too proud to take the jobs that are available. And even if it were true that they're taking up the jobs, our ancestors were allowed to immigrate here. Many of whom came because of, persecution, religious persecution or otherwise in Europe or some other place. And at what point are we allowed to shut down the borders and not let people do what our own ancestors did? We live here because the doors were open to them. Who's to say that we have the right before God to suddenly cut off that welcome to other people who want to come on the same terms that our ancestors came here on? God told the Israelites to never despise or mistreat a foreigner or a sojourner in their midst, because they had known that situation themselves in Egypt. Our ancestors knew persecution in foreign countries and were glad to be able to come over to this country to find freedom, but many of them have forgotten that. Well, our ancestors are dead, and we, their descendants, have often forgotten that we are here because certain people came here as what would have been illegal aliens. I mean, the Indians didn't invite them. The Indians didn't grant them visas to stay. They came and they just came because the land was here and they could get here, and they did. And I personally think that while political expedience and economic expedience might be argued in favor of keeping these people out, just plain Christian generosity and ethics and the principles laid out here in the law suggest that you don't send back a refugee when he's escaped from an oppressive master. Anyway, of course, our government is not governed by the laws of God completely. Verse 17, there shall be no ritual harlot or daughters of the daughters of Israel, or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. That'd be a male prostitute, such as the Canaanite and other heathen religions had. They had male and female prostitutes in their temples of their gods and their goddesses, and sexual perverted activity or immoral activity was a part of their worship. What he's saying is, you shall never adopt those practices in the worship of Jehovah. No Israelite male or female should ever become a prostitute, even for ritual purposes, as the Canaanites do. Then he says, you shall not bring the hire of a harlot or the price of a dog to the house of the Lord your God for any vowed offering. For both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. Now, the price of a harlot, you know exactly what that means. The hire of a dog might be confusing, but the word dog there probably parallels the perverted one of the previous verse. A male prostitute is called a dog here. The idea is, don't go out and prostitute yourself and then bring the money you made on it to the Lord and vow it to the Lord, as if you've done God some kind of a favor. God's not as interested in the money as he is in your moral life. You may be familiar with the cult, the Children of God, who practice what they call flirty fishing, where there's absolutely no morality in this cult. I mean, they are totally sexually unrestrained in all their behavior. The founder himself is a polygamist with about 20 wives, and he's also involved in homosexual relationships and also necrophilia, which is sex with the dead. It's a demonic thing. I mean, the cult is absolutely perverted. But they represent themselves as Christians for a long time. They no longer have any credibility in that claim, but when they started out, they were considered a Christian community. And their founder just got weirder and weirder and weirder, and he's Moses David Berg, total weirdo, weirdo pervert. But one of the things that first began to become evident that they weren't Christians is that one of their evangelistic methods was they'd send their girls out to seduce men. And on the grounds that, although, of course they weren't even saying fornication was bad, but that it was certainly a good thing if you're bringing people into the movement that way. Seduce men and draw men in through their sexual desire into the movement. Well, this would be tantamount to bringing the hire of a harlot to the Lord. I mean, basically saying, we're doing things that the Bible forbids, but at least we're offering something to the Lord, and you know, for it, you know. And that's what God says. No, I'm not so interested in your money. I'm not so interested in numbers. I'm interested in quality, not quantity. I'm interested in purity, not, you know, profit. Now, verse 19. You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out on interest. To a foreigner you may charge interest, but to your brother you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all to which you set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you. It would be a sin to you if you don't pay it. But if you abstain from vowing in the first place, it shall not be a sin to you. That which has gone from your lips, the promise you make, you shall keep and perform. For you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. Now, we know about vows from other portions in the Pentateuch. Numbers chapter 30 was entirely taken up with the subject of vows, Numbers 30. But other places have mentioned vows. The idea was that no one had to vow to give God anything other than what was required in the law, his first fruits and his tithes and sacrifices. Apart from that, you didn't have to give God anything. But if you chose to, if you vowed to, then you had to do it. A vow is a voluntary promise. Once you had made it, you were expected to keep your promise. If you didn't make the promise in the first place, that was okay. But if you do make the promise, you cannot default on it without bringing guilt upon yourself. It says in Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 and 5, where it's talking about, it's basically restating the same law, but in a preachy sort of way. Because Ecclesiastes means the preacher. But Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 4 and 5 says, when you make any vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. It is better not to vow than to vow and not pay. So that's the same thing the law says. Solomon enforces that as saying that you're a fool if you violate it, because you're making God your enemy. That's never a wise thing to do. Verse 24, when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of the grapes at your pleasure, but you shall not bring in any container. When you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand. You shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain, though. In other words, if you happen to be traveling through, and of course there'd be grain fields and vineyards all over Israel, anyone who's traveling didn't have to pack a lunch. He could just grab a few heads of grain and rub them together and eat them while he walked through, or grab a cluster of grapes, and he could do that. That was permitted. This would also make sure that the poor would never have to starve, because they could always do this too. But you couldn't walk in your neighbor's field with a bushel basket and start harvesting and take it all home. That was going too far. The idea was your neighbor should be willing to part with a few heads of grain to satisfy a neighbor's needs. But to share the harvest with all his neighbors, you know, that'd be asking too much. All the poor neighbors come and harvest the grain, and then the owner doesn't get any. The idea is that you can eat what you need for the moment, but you can't store up unless you buy it from your neighbor, of course. Now, you might recall a time when in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus and his disciples were walking through a grain field, and they did just that. They plucked the grain and started eating it in their rubbing it in their hands and eating it. And they were accused with breaking the law by the Pharisees. But not, it wasn't that they were taking somebody else's grain. That was not the law they were violating. It was said they were violating the Sabbath, because it happened to do this on the Sabbath, and they called that harvesting on the Sabbath, and they didn't allow that on the Sabbath. But Jesus said they were guiltless and that they shouldn't have been accused. At any rate, it might seem strange that they were permitted to walk through someone's grain and just eat it, but that was permitted in the law. Therefore, they weren't breaking any law by doing that. Now, chapter 24 deals with divorce. In fact, it's the only place in the law that gives us any instructions about divorce. We're told in other places in the Old Testament that God gets offended by certain cases of divorce. I believe it's in Nehemiah. And also, I think, in Ezra, both. Two different times in Israel's history after the exile, the Israelite men had divorced their Israelite wives and married pagan women. And they were rebuked for this. And in at least one case, I think it was in Nehemiah's day, they were made to divorce their second wives, to put away those wives and the children they'd married. Part of this was due to the fact that they had married pagan women, but also it was offensive that they had divorced their first wives. The divorce was not forbidden in the law, as we shall see from this chapter. Another time when divorce is spoken of, though not in a legal way, is in Malachi chapter 2, which Malachi rebukes the people for doing the same thing I just mentioned, divorcing their older wives and marrying young non-Jewish girls. And God says he hates putting away, he hates divorce. And so even though divorce was permitted, it's quite clear divorce never was what God really intended as the norm for marriage. In fact, he intended marriage to be lifelong, and Jesus taught that using this very passage. Actually, the Pharisees came to Jesus using this passage, Deuteronomy 24, in Matthew 19. And they said, Moses commanded us to give a writing of divorcement. And Jesus said, no, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but that's not what God intended for marriage in the first place. He intended that the two should be one flesh, and what God has joined together, no man should put asunder. So Jesus taught that in spite of the fact that the law could be shown to allow divorce, it never was God's highest intention. Now, when we read what Jesus said about divorce in chapter 5 of Matthew and in chapter 19 of Matthew and in the parallels in the other Gospels, we could get the impression that divorce is an unqualified evil in almost any circumstance, except, of course, for the case of fornication. And it is an evil thing. It's a very evil thing. But some people go so far, at least in the modern church, as to say divorce for any cause is sinful. Regardless of even if it's adultery or remarriage is out of the question or whatever, and if you remarry, you're committing adultery regardless. And they make marriage to be the ultimate value. Now, I think marriage is a sacred thing, and no one can violate marriage vows without incurring God's anger and without being in sin about it. But I don't think it's the unforgivable sin. And in certain churches, if you're married, I mean, if you're divorced, or especially if you're divorced and remarried, you can never be a first-class Christian. Even in certain Pentecostal denominations, though they will let you in the church, they won't let you ever be in the ministry in their denomination if you're divorced and remarried. Now, it doesn't matter what your circumstances were. It may be that you were a faithful husband and your wife, you know, played the harlot and ran off. Doesn't matter. It's just scandalous that you've been divorced and remarried. And I have one friend who's divorced and remarried, and he goes to a church that has that policy. And he was in the ministry before his divorce. But that church won't let him be in the ministry now. And he was telling me, he said, if I had murdered my wife and remarried after repenting, they would let me be a minister in this church. But the fact that I was faithful to my wife and she ran off with another man and I remarried will prevent me from ever being a minister in this denomination. I mean, that just shows how mixed up modern Christians can get this issue. You know, murder with repentance of your wife and then remarrying would not prevent you from being in that denomination. In fact, they'd probably put you on the circuit as a one to give your testimony. I was a murderer and then I got saved. But if you were a faithful husband and an adulterous wife ran away from you and you remarried, well then, you're ostracized. You're stigmatized forever. That is simply putting too much weight on divorce. It is true, Jesus said, if you divorce your wife for a cause other than fornication, you are guilty of adultery. But even adultery can be forgiven. Of course, the question of whether you should divorce your second spouse is often debated. But let me just say this. Divorce and remarriage, if it was always wrong, should never have been permitted in the law of God, which is said to have been perfect and holy. It's clear that under certain circumstances, God allowed divorce or remarriage. He also allowed certain other things that we don't think are ideal, like polygamy, which we know is not an ideal situation. But the point is, if something was universally, morally wrong under every circumstance, God should never have permitted it in His Word. For instance, He never really permitted adultery. He forbade that. People would be put to death for that. Stealing was not permitted. Murder was not permitted. And while the law doesn't present as high a standard for us as the New Testament does, nonetheless, it never permitted anything that was in itself an unqualified evil. Therefore, for example, something like polygamy or divorce, which we know are very substandard, are not the kinds of things that can be said to, in every case, be an absolute wrong. For instance, if you go to a country as a missionary and you convert the tribal chief and he has 8 wives, what do? He's a Christian now. Does he have to give up 7 of his wives? I don't think so. Now, I have an African friend who said in his country, in Africa, in Kenya,
When a person like that got converted, he had to give up all of his wives except his first one. But I don't think the Bible can support that. I think the church enforces that there. But in the Old Testament, David, Abraham, Jacob, Solomon had many wives, and while Solomon's wives turned him from God, and that was a sin, we're not told that the polygamy itself was considered a sin. It was never ideal, and the Bible always points out that it's not good. But what if a man is already married before he's converted to several wives? Divorce is forbidden. If he's made vows to these women, the Bible does forbid him to divorce them. It doesn't forbid him to live up to his vows that he's previously made. It's a complicated issue, but I would say that we have to be careful that we don't impose what the Bible presents as the ideal as a legalistic, unbending standard when God himself bent and flexed the rule a little bit in the Old Testament. He allowed for substandard things. Now, that doesn't mean that we ever would teach substandard things, but it means that when we deal with people who have not measured up, we need to be careful not to be more inflexible than God was on the subject. If someone comes to me and they have an unhappy marriage, I will counsel them, do not divorce. Do not divorce. If they disregard my counsel and go ahead and divorce, then I will say, you've done a wrong thing. But how do I treat them? Do I stigmatize them the rest of their lives? Or if they repent, do I just figure, well, they did a wrong thing. I've done a lot of wrong things myself. They're still a brother or sister in good standing now. I mean, we need to have as much flexibility as God did. I don't think we should have less flexibility than the law had. The law was pretty rigid. And if we're more rigid than the law, then I don't know. I know that Jesus presented a higher standard, but I don't think he was more rigid and legalistic than the law was. The standard is what we aim at, but in many ways we offend, all of us offend, and we all fall short in many ways. And I think when we meet somebody who has sinned by divorcing their spouse, for instance, if they've repented, I don't think that's something that God would have us hold against them. Here, for example, divorce was allowed for unspecified reasons. And remarriage, by the way, I'd have you notice that if there was something universally immoral about divorce and remarriage, then God should have never been flexible enough to allow it, even for the harmless of their hearts, in the law, in his holy and perfect law. I would also point out that in Jeremiah and Hosea, God himself likened himself to a husband whose wife, Israel, had committed adultery, and he divorced her and took another. So, apparently the concept of divorce and remarriage is not an unqualified evil. It certainly is it is not the standard. It is not the ideal. It is not what God intended to happen for marriage. But it is not the kind of thing that you can make the inflexible rule to impose and destroy people over, or to keep people at arm's length about, which I don't believe that God does. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand, and he sends her out of his house. When she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies, who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Now, the law seems to state that if a man finds some uncleanness in his wife, he may divorce her by giving her a certificate of divorce. It doesn't actually say he can. It just says if he does. It doesn't give explicit permission to do it, although Jesus, in talking about this, said Moses permitted you to give your wife a certificate of divorce, but God didn't really intend that as his ideal. But it doesn't come out and say he may do it. It just says if he does, then she goes on to marry someone else. Again, it doesn't say specifically that she might, and that she's allowed to, but it just assumes that she will. She has to marry someone. She has to survive somehow. She gets married again. Now, Jesus said, in speaking on this, that if this is the case for any reason, if the uncleanness involved, for which the man put away his wife, is anything other than adultery on her part, then by divorcing her, he is forcing her to commit adultery. That is, she goes and remarries, it is adulterous. Because it was not, there was no proper grounds for the divorce in the first place. She's still, in God's sight, married to her first husband and now going to be married to someone else. But Jesus did allow fornication as a grounds to be an exception to that. It says, if the second husband also puts her away likewise, it doesn't say what her options are. The implication may be that she can go marry another, but she can't go back to her first husband. It doesn't explicitly say she could have a third husband, but it doesn't say she couldn't either. But one thing it says is she can't go back to the first. Now, why is that? I've always wondered that, and no doubt when you read it, you wondered too. Why that law? I mean, what's the point there? Wouldn't it glorify God for the first couple to get back together? After all, they were the original couple. Wouldn't that be something God would like to see happen, at least if the second marriage was a disaster and she was going to marry someone, shouldn't it be her first husband as first choice? Actually, it doesn't permit it. Now, commentators have suggested a variety of possible reasons for this legislation. One of them is that it would possibly protect a woman in several ways. One, it would discourage a husband from hastily divorcing his wife, because on the chance that she might marry another, he would never have again a chance to have her back if he ever regretted his choice. If, however, he had the choice of having her back at any time in the future, he might hastily divorce her and then just figure, I'll get her back someday. But if he divorces her and she ends up marrying someone else, then even if that marriage ends in divorce, he can't have her back. So he'd have to think twice before just lightly putting her away, because it would be a permanent thing. He couldn't necessarily get her back. It is also suggested by some commentators that this law was to protect the second marriage from harassment by the first husband. That once she had married a second man, if her husband wanted her back, he might harass that marriage and try to persuade her to come back, but he couldn't, because under the law she couldn't come back to him in any case. Even if the second marriage ended, she couldn't come back to him. So he might as well not waste his time. It leaves the second marriage unmolested, unharassed by the first husband, who might have changed his mind in the meantime. It also, in a sense, protects the dignity of a woman. If a man divorces her and she goes and marries someone else, and he divorces her and she goes back to first, it's sort of like she's just getting passed back and forth. There's no linear course that her life is taking. She's just kind of being passed back and forth by these men, or at least has the appearance of being, and somewhat an undignified use of a woman. Now, these are all different suggestions that have been made why God might have given this law. We don't know if any of those are the correct reason, but any of them might give a rationale why God would be protecting the woman's dignity in the marriage and her rights in the marriage by making this unusual decree. Frankly, I have a different opinion about its reason. We are told that marriage, and Jesus and the Apostle Paul both tell us this, especially Paul does in Ephesians 5, that marriage, when it was instituted in the Garden of Eden, was to be a picture of Christ in the church. In other words, marriage itself is a ceremonial thing that points to something beyond itself, some spiritual reality above and beyond itself, namely a relationship with Christ in the church. It is therefore conceivable that the divorce law also points to something spiritual. Paul says in Romans 7 that we were first married to the law. That marriage has come to an end, however, and we're now married to Christ. Okay? You're familiar with that passage in Romans 7, verses 1 through 5. We were married to the law, that marriage has come to an end, now we're married to Christ. It may be that God anticipated this use of this analogy of marriage, and that for the woman to go back to her first husband would be an abomination. Just like for a Christian who is no longer married to the law and married to Christ, to go back into the law is to depart from Christ and to do an abominable and unthinkable thing. And since marriage itself is declared in the New Testament to be a picture of Christ in the church and our relationship to Christ, it is not unreasonable to suppose that the Old Testament law about divorce that forbade her to go back to her first husband might also have the same intention. That is a spiritual one. Once we have escaped from that marriage to the law and been married to Christ, that there is no possibility of us legitimately going back to the law, our first husband. So there is a possible meaning to this too. By the way, it does not specify what kind of uncleanness is regarded as proper grounds for divorce, and therefore it remained a dispute among the Jews of later generations trying to interpret this. The school of Hillel, one of the rabbis, taught that any cause at all was grounds for divorce. Another school of the rabbis, a guy named Shammai and his followers, taught no, only sexual misconduct within the marriage is grounds for divorce. When Jesus was asked about this, he said only fornication is grounds for divorce. But even that has been variously interpreted by modern Christians. Does this mean only fornication that the woman commits after she's married? That's the way most understand it, and I tend to understand it that way. That if the woman commits sexual misconduct after marriage, she has broken the covenant, and therefore if the husband annuls his side of the covenant and divorces her, he is not guilty because she is the one who broke it, not him. But there is another school of thought, at least worthy of consideration. I don't agree with it, but it has some support, some things to support it, so I should present it. Some believe that when Jesus says, he who divorces his wife except for the cause of fornication, means that if he marries her and finds that previous to the marriage she has committed fornication, he can put her away in that case and only in that case. That is, if there's been a misrepresentation to him on the time that he married her, he thought he was married a virgin and she wasn't. Now, in support of this, we can see back a couple chapters back that there was a law about this. If a man married a girl and found out she wasn't a virgin, he would come and try to prove she wasn't a virgin so he could divorce her. Which might suggest that he couldn't divorce her otherwise. He couldn't divorce her unless he had found her not to be a virgin at the time of marriage. And that would suggest perhaps the uncleanness in Deuteronomy 24. He marries a woman, he finds some uncleanness there. Basically, that she wasn't a virgin, as he thought. And therefore, he can divorce her, and she can marry someone else. So there is some support for this notion, and even Jesus' wording could be construed to mean that. One reason I don't understand it that way, although as I think you can see, it's got a good case in its favor. One reason I don't see it that way is that the man in the previous chapter who accused his wife of not being a virgin, and then he proved to be a false himself and she really was a virgin, he was, it says, not allowed to marry her all the days of his life after that. That was his penalty. Now, it suggests, at least to me, that if he had not made this false accusation against her, he would have been in a position possibly to divorce her on one pretext or another at some later time. But the fact that he brought this false accusation against her removes his right to divorce. It's part of his penalty for having lied. And it suggests that if not for that sin on his part, he would have had the option of divorce, perhaps on other grounds, later in the marriage, under the law. And therefore, it would suggest that some things besides that one offense would be grounds for divorce, though they're not specified. And the rabbis never could agree about it. Jesus used the word fornication, which doesn't necessarily restrict its meaning to premarital sex. Porneia in the Greek just means illicit, immoral sexual conduct. It could be conduct she did before she was married. It could be conduct she does after marriage. It could be adultery. It could be bestiality. It could be incest. It could be homosexuality. And of course, I understand Jesus' words to apply to both sexes, that the party whose spouse has committed these immoral acts has the right to divorce. But I don't believe that Jesus is saying they should. He's just saying that if they divorce for any other reason than that, they're committing a terrible sin. And if they divorce for those reasons, they're not committing a terrible sin. But even if they divorce for those reasons, they may not be doing the right thing, the best thing, the most loving thing. And biblically, I believe that even a man whose wife has committed adultery or a woman whose husband has should seek avenues of restoration of the marriage and forgiveness. Well, we've run a bit to the end of our time and we're not yet through chapter 24. I think we might as well take our break at this time, and we'll pick up chapter 24, verse 5, next time.